So my name is Justine Hyde. I work at the Institute for Community Health in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And I'm going to talk with you a little bit about a study that I conducted back in, it was 2008-2009. I had a career development grant from NIH to do some more training in trauma. I'm an anthropologist by training, so I wanted to get some more training in trauma and trauma-informed care. And then it allowed me to do a small formative study, a qualitative study with adolescents and out-of-home placements. And so I'm going to talk a little bit, put this talk in context of mental health as a chronic public health, what I would call a chronic public health disaster, but I would like to put it in a public health framework, and then I'll tell you a little bit about the study and share some recommendations that have come from the youth and providers that work with them. So I think that many of you are probably familiar with the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study conducted by Vincent Felitti and Robert Anda. It was conducted in the 1990s, and it was a pretty incredible study, in my humble opinion, looking at the relationship between exposure to adverse childhood experiences and chronic health problems as adults. They surveyed 17,000, and then later added some more, but originally almost 17,500 Kaiser Permanente insurance holders, and asked about 10 adverse childhood experiences, and then went back in their medical records and looked to see for those who had these experiences, what was their health status like. And they've produced a number of studies from this and have demonstrated pretty strong evidence that exposure to adverse childhood experiences is related to many of the public health problems and challenges that we talk about and are trying to address every day. Obesity, diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, depression, early death, risk factors, smoking, overeating, alcoholism, and drug use. So there's, the greater number of adverse childhood experiences, the more likely you are to have these chronic health problems into adulthood. And where they found real differences in the population was four or more, those who've experienced four or more experiences. Their focus was primarily on adverse childhood experiences in the home. So I think that's important to point out. It's not exposure to community violence or war. These were experiences in the home, such as maternal mental illness, alcoholism, parental incarceration, abuse, neglect, sexual abuse. So they are all things that happened in the home. So we know that there are some populations that are more vulnerable than others to the experience of adverse childhood experiences, and certainly youth, and we're in the care and protection of child welfare systems in our states, are among those that are very vulnerable. They don't get removed from their homes because they haven't experienced at least some of these. So they have experienced multiple adverse events in the home that have often led them to be placed outside. That leads to complex emotional, physical development. They experience multiple transitions that impact their ability to form trusting, supportive relationships. They enter into what I would consider to be, at best, fragmented systems of care. And when they're in the care and protection of the state, their primary concern for a long time, and I still think to this day, because I do work in the child welfare system, still that the primary concerns are still on physical safety, and we're trying to focus more on child well-being, but it's complicated and budgets have been cut, and, you know, I still think that physical safety is the primary concern. So my questions, I had a if you know me, you know that I probably had a lot of questions. So for this talk, some of the questions of this study that I wanted to learn from adolescents were, what were their experiences like in the care and protection when they're in out-of-home placements? How did they understand and cope with their early adverse childhood experiences? And what services were put in place to, did they see being put into place to help them? So again, this is primarily from their perspective. I also did 20 interviews with professionals who work with adolescents in out-of-home placements, and those were primarily psychologists, psychiatrists, child advocates, lawyers, child lawyers. And so I have, I'm not going to talk a lot about what their perspective was. I'll bring in one slide. But so the focus will be on what the adolescents thought today. I recruited from one area office just because it was a small sample of 20. Every area office in Massachusetts has their own culture and their own reputation, and I tried to minimize that with such a small sample. So I have 20 adolescents and from one area office, and I conducted two semi-structured interviews with them. And the first interview was really sort of a get-to-know-you interview, focused on sort of what their current living situation was like, what services they were connected to, and wherever else the conversation allowed us to go. And then the second interview, I focused more on how they got into care and what that experience was like coming into care for them. So the sample, there were about 50-50, male, female. Was ethnically diverse, 35% were Black, and that includes in Cambridge, it's African-American and Haitian predominantly, 25% white Hispanic, 30% white non-Hispanic, and 10% were of mixed race. The average age of entry into DCF care for the sample was 12.8, so almost 13 years, and the range of time in care was 2 to 6 years. Despite fostering connections and lots of federal policies to have children in care for less than 2 years, that was not the experience of this group. 65% entered under a care and protection petition, so that was a substantiated case of abuse or neglect. 35% entered as a child in need of services, and so parent had voluntarily placed them. But of that 35%, I would say a good number of them could also have been in care under care and protection. They just didn't enter that way. And then they also, I think it's important to point out that all of them had had multiple placements and transitions once they got into foster care, and the range was 3 to 9. So some of them had had an awful lot of transitions in the, 2 to 6 years that they'd been in care. So I pulled out, just from the transcripts, I did not ask people, did you experience this? Did you experience this? These experiences came out during the course of conversation, either in the first or second interview. So I looked at with the adverse childhood experience that Felidi and Anda had surveyed folks about, and found evidence looked to see how my sample compared to their adverse childhood experiences. The mean number was 4, and some of them had a lot more, so that was the mean number. Everyone had been separated from a parent or guardian because they were in out-of-home placements, physical abuse, verbal abuse, substance abuse, and domestic violence were quite common. So I wanted to highlight that and then just draw attention to the fact that the mean number is 4, and that's so if we're estimating right or if Lydia and Ananda are right, this group of 20, many of them are going to have chronic health conditions as they turn into adults. So when I asked them what kinds of supports and services were in place, They had all been referred to mental health counseling. I think it's pretty common that people in the care and protection of the child welfare services are referred for mental health counseling. Not all of them were engaged in counseling at the time of our interviews. Some have just burned out and decided not to go anymore. They'd all been in support group. Almost all of them had been in support groups or group counseling. That often takes place if they're in a residential group home or a residential facility. Groups are pretty standard. I think it's really important to know that 85% of them had been on psychotropic medications, which is very high, and many of them had been on multiple medications, and I'll get to that. I have a slide on that in a minute. Family counseling had been offered to about 30% said that they were in family counseling, and about 20% were in wraparound support services, and some of them were Catherine Grimes's MSPB program, Mental Health Services Program for Youth.
You know we're going to both end up here.
Yeah. She did not tell me to say that. So I'm going to just present what they thought about these different sorts of supports that they were offered. And, you know, I think the intent of offering these supports is to help them cope with, gain some skills and tools to deal with their experiences. Mental health counseling is a primary tool in our toolkit, I would say, and that the majority felt quite ambivalent about the counseling, ambivalent at best, about the mental health counseling that they had received. One young man said, "I think therapy has its ups and downs. I was never really impressed with it. Some days it would be all right. I'd get to say what's going on, but that was probably the best thing, to get the small stuff off my chest." And so while that is an important, you know, I think, to get the small stuff off your chest, I think when people describe their mental health counseling, a lot of them didn't really understand the purpose. They didn't really, weren't really quite sure what they were supposed to be getting out of it or what they were supposed to do. They had the experience of sitting in a room, having someone ask them a lot of questions. And, you know, after the third or fourth therapist, they didn't really want to do that anymore. And this is also a common experience that this young woman described, that no one ever said anything to her about her family and all the violence and drugs. And people felt like, you know, the reason why they are in the care and the protection of the state was it was their fault. And I am clearly not a therapist. I'm an anthropologist, remember, but I assume that one of the things that you do in therapy is try to understand, you know, what's happened in your family and in your life, and sort of put that into a context. And but that was not what some young people had experienced. And when people did find it helpful, it often, counseling happened in non-traditional settings. It happened outside of the office. It wasn't just a bunch of questions about how I'm feeling. And here, one young woman describes being in Catherine's program, the MSPB program. You know, she was offered a lot of opportunities. It was a wraparound services program that had clinicians and caseworkers and family supports. But she got to do a lot of things as a result of being in the program that she wouldn't have been offered otherwise. It created an outlet for her to find people who were having problems with their families, and she was able to grow from that. And she also talked about her clinician picking her up from school, and they'd go to Burger King or they'd go to a coffee shop, or, you know, they would just sort of hang out, and that was very helpful for her. So I think it was counseling that happened in non-traditional settings that people found to be. Sometimes kids had been referred to very small, supportive schools, and they had counseling as part of the school program, and some of the kids found it helpful to be involved in that. The group counseling, people had pretty mixed feelings about the support they were provided through group sessions. It was most effective when the facilitator of a group really allowed people to learn from each other, so really to dialogue and sort of debate back and forth. But most felt that it was kind of the same old thing every week. There was often, again, a lack of clarity on the purpose, and it was hard to get anything meaningful out of group counseling, especially in residential settings when kids were coming and going all the time. There was not really any consistent group to form a relationship with. Psychotropic medications seemed to be a strategy that was used to help young people cope and probably deal with a lot of behavioral issues that they were having. Nearly all had been placed on psychotropic medications. All but one had been on multiple medications simultaneously. And only two of the 17 had told me that they were probably going to continue their medications after they turned 18. So why do they discontinue? I think this is, you know, there's federal policy that's been put into place with the Innovations Act of 2011. You know, really trying to curb the use of psychotropic medications as a primary treatment strategy. And I think the experience of being on medications, and people didn't, a lot of young people didn't actually understand why they were on the medications they were on. They didn't know what their diagnoses were. This one 17-year-old girl had told me the day that I interviewed her that she had just found out from her most recent therapist that she had ADHD, bipolar, and all this stuff. She'd been taking meds for a long time. She doesn't know what her pills are, but she's taken a lot of things. And I said, how did you feel when she told you that you had these things? And she said, well, I don't think I have all these things, but I guess I do. That's what they say I have, and that's what I have. I can't argue with them. So as this young person turns 18, you know, I think what this highlights to me is just how disempowered young people are about their mental health care and their treatments, and I think that is alarming and something to consider. So other people didn't think they needed the medications. They did not like the way they made them feel. This is a common occurrence that they made them feel sick. They tried to tell people that the medications they were on were making them sick, and many of them were not successful in changing them. So I'm going to move on. I think that from the provider perspective, we're missing opportunities to help young people process and understand their experiences. People talked about, particularly the psychiatrists, in particular, they felt like that they're just dealing with a fragmented system of care, and they just don't have enough time that they need to have to understand what's happening with a young person before they prescribe meds or another course of treatment. I think people felt like the most vulnerable youth are treated by the least experienced providers, and that caregivers and congregate staff are not equipped to identify and address symptoms of trauma. And one child advocate said, I feel like we're just putting a lid on a boiling pot of water and waiting till they turn 18. So my recommendations in the 1 minute that I'm going to have, this more or less sums it up better than anything that I could say. You know, this young woman here, when she turned 18, you know, is really when she started advocating for herself, because she could. She could stay on voluntarily. She could leave. She didn't have anything to lose anymore. And they take you more seriously when you're older, but she feels bad for the younger kids because they never listen to them and they never listen to anything they say. So if we were to change anything, and I certainly want to acknowledge that people are creating strategies for young people to provide more input and take more ownership over their treatment plans and the services that they're involved in, I think we have some more ways to go. But recommendations for active participation of youth in decision making. I think we need to really communicate what is the purpose of treatment, what is it intended to do? Is it, and then check in, is this meeting your needs? Are you getting what you want out of it? I think we need to rely less on psychotropic medications. And we need to educate youth and providers about mental health. And I think lastly, for the public health systems, child abuse, maltreatment, violence, the chaotic experiences that children have, they're not just child welfare concerns. And if we're going to make any traction in this area, we need to think about adverse childhood experiences as a public health problem, which means that we need to start focusing some more prevention, serious prevention efforts in this area. And, you know, the Improvement Innovations Act that passed in 2011 requires child welfare to work with mental health and Medicaid, minimally. And that's done a lot for state child welfare agencies and their sort of ability to work collaboratively across systems to improve care. Right now it's primarily focused on monitoring medications, but I think that that kind of collaboration, those kinds of collaborations are what are needed to also then move into child well-being and improving child well-being. So I will end since I'm out of time. Thank you very much.